This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In Podcast Network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 7 of the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host as always, Elwood Jones of From the Depths of the Hell. And joining me, of course, is my co-host, Mr. Stephen Lever. And even Mr. Stephen Palmer, even.
Hello, Elwood. Thanks for having me again.
Now, obviously, on tonight's show, we are going to be looking at a film by Sion Sono, which is the 2007, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing this correct, X'd. Or Hair Extensions, as it was known in the States.
Yeah, I think it's XD, Hair Extensions. That'll do.
Okay. Because we're obviously talking about Sion Sono, we're going to be going into a little bit of a capsule history of the director, and who many people are seeing as taking over from Takashi Miike when it comes to being the outlaw director of choice. But before we obviously get into all that, I think we have to start with obviously a bit of sad news, because over here in the UK, one of the first and major online disc distribution agencies or disc rental companies, whatever way you want to call them, Love Film have called time on their actual physical media side of things. They were previously their own entity, then they got bought up by Amazon and started doing their streaming through what's now obviously essentially Amazon Prime, but they were still doing the discs on the side. And now they've decided that physical media is no longer the way they wish to go, and they've called time on the whole thing, which I don't know about anyone else, but for myself, it's kind of sad, especially when you're a fan of sort of specialist sort of cinema, should we say? So anything like foreign or cult and obscure sort of cinema. So like the films that we obviously see through label searches like Fair Window Films or Arrow Films, these are going to be like titles that are going to be a lot harder to obviously access because they don't tend to turn up too often on like Netflix or Amazon Prime, sort of the streaming services. So I have to ask Stephen, are you obviously as sad by me as the end of another end really for physical media? I mean, first it was obviously Blockbuster and the mom and pop stores, and now the online rental stores are obviously going as well.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I don't really rent anymore. But Love Film were the first sort of people I used to get physical, you know, rent physical films online. So, like, say after the death of Blockbuster, I did go Love Film and I had things from them. And actually, there are films that we will talk about which I could only get through Love Film. Yeah. I assume that, you know, it was eventually going to end once they got bought by Amazon. It just feels physical media, I wonder where it'll be in 10 years time, other than just for people like me and probably you who still need the tactile ownership of something that we like. But the generation maybe after us aren't so attached to that, and they're quite happy to have everything at their fingertips through streaming.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main reason we like to have something, a disc to hold, some tactile media, is purely because of the fact that we ain't going to see these films any other way. And when we look at companies such as Arrow, and in particular we look at their recent, say for example, we take a look at the release for Female Prisoner Scorpion, which they put out in a lovely box set, and of course limited to what about, should we say, about 200,000 copies or something? It was like a very small run that they did, and then that's it.
I think it was 4,000. I think it was even lower than that.
It's just they put out these small little numbers, and at the same time, they just get bought up, and then the only way you get to then try and pick them up is if you're going the trader route, who obviously then try and rip you off. I mean, when we look at Battles Without Honor and Humanity, that lovely sort of set that was sort of like their first test run for these, that was retailing about £50. It's now going, looking on Amazon, we're looking about 110 minimum. that you can expect now to pick up that set for, and I think it's just absolutely ridiculous, and another reason that old trailers should be shot, but, you know, that's just me. And there is no alternative, really, of how are we supposed to obviously see and watch these films. I mean, obviously Arrow have got like a little bolt-on channel that you can add on to Amazon Prime, but again, it's a very small selection of their quite epic catalogue of films that they have. I mean, they essentially took over where Tartan left off in many ways. When you look at the sort of breadth and selection that they have, and it's just a shame that they've not gone and created some sort of decent sort of streaming service. I mean, we obviously, what are our options really? I mean, we can get bits of Shaw Brothers on Amazon Prime. We can get various Salvation dramas on Netflix. Mubai, again, when it's not just so focused on Art House, we'll occasionally get some Asian cinema filtered through there. But there's no seemingly service dedicated to Asian cinema, which is, I think, what we need. We need something, because at the moment, when we look at the streaming services for Asian cinema, it's mainly anime. So things like Crunchyroll or High Five.
Yeah, so I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head there with Arrow, because actually some of their stuff is available on Amazon Prime. Other bits are on iTunes. in terms of rental, you know, and some of it's somewhere else. And I think that's the problem I have with the streaming services is to get a decent selection. You might have to pay 3-4 different monthly subscriptions. I mean, iTunes is still sort of parental.
Yeah.
I think it's only the music they have in the streaming way, but they'll be there soon. And that's the struggle for me, is that, you know, we used to be able to go to Blockbuster and there would be a wide enough selection. Yeah. We used to get something from Love Film and there'd be a wide enough selection. The challenges of licensing and things like that really make the streaming services, as good as they are, now the internet's getting better. I mean, the internet, I've got fine internet. I don't really have a problem with streaming. But how many streaming services do I have to sign up for? Now, there are, with Asian cinema in particular, there are Chinese services that can be got here and quite often have UK British subtitles, so there are options, but the legality is dubious for one, and you know, not everything is actually viewable, so it just feels like sometimes things feel like a natural monopoly, don't they? And I think sort of specialist cult cinema might be part of that.
Yeah, I think it's at the moment it's only becoming all the more rewarding to go out and do sort of like crate digging and going to like secondhand sort of stores, so things like Entertainment Exchange or your Cash Converters, these sort of stores where people go and trade in their old DVDs and stuff, because more often than not, you'll find that your foreign cinema section will have some really great titles that are being sold off pretty damn cheap. Mainly because they don't assume there's anyone going to buy them.
No, my go-to place is CEX, yeah, and so any time I find one, and some of them have a magnificent world cinema and sometimes even a specific Asian cinema section. I mean, it depends who lives there, and yes, there's only so many copies of Crouching Tiger or Cashern that you might want, but sometimes there's absolute bargains. Or you know, as you say, you go to a boot sale or something like that, and you find some old Hong Kong Legends DVDs from the day. So that's part of the fun of the hobby to a degree. But you're right, it's an end of an era, really.
It's a sad time, I feel, and I think only one, when this sort of sinks in, that I think people are going to realize what we've obviously lost through the end of physical media rental. It's an important avenue that I feel that we've obviously lost there, and I feel that it's been a bit of a sad day to obviously learn of the actual end of Love Film's physical rental, but On the plus side, we did find a couple of good finds with the crate digging, as I managed to pick up a copy of Turtles: The Surprisingly Fastest Swimmers. So you'd be happy to know, Stephen, someone was actually listening to your recommendation. So,
oh, I really hope you enjoy it.
I have a feeling it's going to turn up.
A copy Chore, which you might be hearing about in a fairly soon episode. So that was very good. And of course, as you know, I actually managed to use eBay to get a copy of the aforementioned Blu-ray set of Female Prisoner Scorpion this month. And even though every other copy that I'd seen was going for, as you say, £60, £70, £100, I put in a punt and actually got it for less than the retail.
Oh, God.
But that is, you know, that's once in a lifetime. And now it's, you know, now I'm hugging it a lot and enjoying its very existence, because it's a lovely set with, you know, with the Blu-ray, with the four films, Blu-ray and DVD, and a nice little book. But I'd set my financial limit on it, and it was just one of those times that it came through. But I'm pretty sure 99 times out of 100, I wouldn't have been winning that one.
Yes, I mean, I'm still waiting for the Criterion collection version of the Lone Wolf and Cub series, which again is a really lovely transfer and lovely box set as well. Whether it will actually make it over here or not, I'm not too sure, because Criterion's current deal with their UK distribution is that they won't release a title which has distribution through someone else. They only release titles to the UK that don't already have a distribution deal. So, once again, distribution confusing a lot of things, it has to be said. On other notes, we've seen more footage from the latest Jackie Chan romp, The Foreigner, based on the Stephen Lever book The Chinaman, and in this it seems that they're actually going with the actual literal title, because in the book the so-called Chinaman is actually an ex-Viet Cong soldier. Obviously in the Jackie Chan version he will actually be a Chinaman. But we've seen some footage and it's certainly showing Chan tapping into that darker side again, which we've seen hints of. I mean, we obviously saw it in, like, The Protector. We saw, and we've seen it in some of, like, his later films. Normally, when he was, like, doing Police Story Lockdown, we saw him trying to tap it again into that darker style and moving away from the more comical stuff. So, it's been kind of interesting. Actually been really infused about the footage we've seen released from the film. I mean, are you excited to see The Foreigner?
I couldn't be less excited.
Okay.
No. Obviously, Jackie Chan has his fans. I haven't enjoyed anything he's done for. The last thing I really enjoyed actually was The Karate Kid, the remake that he was in, which I thought was quite an interesting film. But I think he's a bit old for this action crap these days, and I'd rather he grew old gracefully, or China bought us someone new, which I think is a debate and a discussion and a lamentation all of its own, isn't it?
It's hard to say who the next person step up. I mean, obviously at the moment we've got Donnie Yen is finally getting the recognition he's long since deserved. I mean, I thought back when we saw Blade 2 that would be a sort of breakout, and it's sort of taken until now for us to obviously recognize Donnie Yen, and him obviously turning up in Rogue One, and he's been in the latest XXX as well. So it's nice to see him doing projects over here. At the same time, he's still really busy doing films in Hong Kong. So it's great, obviously, seeing that.
But he's not getting any younger, is he? I mean, he's a.
I don't know, but he's only getting better. That's the thing with Donnie Yen.
Certainly, his acting is certainly. Certainly, he was a bit of a joke, really. And in terms of his acting, you know, his obviously his fighting and his choreography was always well respected, but his acting wasn't necessarily as well thought of. But he certainly turned a corner there for sure. But what I don't feel certainly out of that part of the world we have young, fresh talent. There's a lot of pretty boys that won't make it over here. Certainly in terms of martial arts and action cinema, I don't see anybody. There's, you know, we have Tony Jaa from Thailand, who I suspect his day's come and gone. We have the fella from Indonesia, was in the Raid and stuff like that. I can't remember his name. He wastes. But it's, yeah, there was a time we could talk about the golden age of various cinemas in Asia, and there would be lots of male action stars, and you could have your favourites. Now, it's a very empty desert.
I think the only person I can think of would be Daniel Wu, who's currently heading up the AMC series Into the Badlands.
Yeah. So, funnily enough, though, I never think of Daniel Wu as a
martial artist.
He's been around for quite some time. So he was quite a face of sort of the late 90s and early 2000s in Hong Kong cinema. And actually, I really like Daniel Wu. So I'm really pleased that he's managing to headline the Into the Badlands show.
Yeah, and another throwback artist who seems to have really come back into vogue again, and that'd be Mark Dacascos.
Who's he?
He was in the original version of Drive. He was in Crime Freeman. He was in Brotherhood of the Wolf.
Okay, yeah.
Manny.
Yeah, I know who you mean, yeah.
And it's really weird because obviously there's like one half of the viewing audience who obviously know him as the Iron Chef in America, and then there's all these sort of like genre cinema fans who know him as a martial artist. And obviously doing, as we said, he was in Crime Freeman, he was in some slightly less great stuff, such as like Double Dragon and Kickboxer 5 The Redemption, but you know, he seems to have really come back to the forefront again. And when he's obviously doing stuff on like Hawaii 5-0 and stuff, it's sort of like you can see him like slowly getting more and more lead roles again, and it's nice to see him moving away from B movie material and finally getting some proper recognition, which is probably long overdue, really.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. Anyone showing their face is good. But it's this paucity of youth that bothers me, and I just wonder, in the next 20 years, is someone going to break over? That's not it's that constant story, isn't it? In terms of directors, in terms of actors, who is going to break the West? And will it be maybe somebody from South Asia rather than Southeast Asia? So there's been people like Priyanka Chopra, who's obviously made a big splash on American TV and cinema. But, it's fingers in one hand when there's a billion people that are represented by them, you know.
Well, you kind of help but wonder as well, especially with Hollywood and China now in their working relationship, are we obviously going to start, is this going to encourage us to see a new revival interest within what we seem to be like a more traditional style of Hong Kong cinema? I'm very curious to see who's obviously going to now start coming across into the mainstream as the result of this relationship. Let us know on the Facebook page. We have obviously got the Facebook page, which is the Asian Cinema Film Club. If you look us up, click like, let us know what you think, or let us know in the comment sections below, whether you listen to this on Podomatic or iTunes, or maybe over at our home base, thatmomentin.com. Let us know wherever you happen to be listening to this, who you think the next sort of breakout star for Asian cinema is going to be. We'd certainly love to hear. Now, obviously, tonight we're talking about Sion Sono. This is a director who I would say sort of like the last few years has really sort of come to the forefront through films such as like Why Don't You Play in Hell, Tokyo Tribe, Cold Fish. He has sort of like picked up that mantle, as we said at the start of the show, from Takashi Miike, is producing the sort of films that were reminiscent of his outlaw period that basically led the Hawaiian invasion of like the early 2000s, when he was like doing films such as like Dead or Alive and Audition and Ishii the Killer. And same when we put it up on the Facebook page, we were talking about this film. There were several people who got really excited about it, in particular David Brooker of the Blueprint Review, who cited both like the film we're going to discuss this evening and Suicide Club as being personal favourites of him. But, I mean, where did you get the introduction to Sion Sonic? What was your first introduction to him, Stephen?
Well, my personal introduction to him would have been through Suicide Club / Suicide Circle. So as part of the J horror boom, you know, you find out about Ringu and Audition, and then you start finding about other things, and you start going to websites dedicated to Asian cinema, and actually in my case particularly horror cinema. And then there was this story, there's this film that's it opens with 54 schoolgirls committing suicide on the train, and so you hunt it down. But and I imported it from Japan at the time, and was given, you know, a movie with that. And actually what I ended up doing was getting really quite interested in this guy, because he's very different, you know, absolutely. That I could absolutely see the linkage between him and Takashi Miike in terms of the amount and the varied nature and quite often crazy shit that they do in terms of their output, but they actually come from a completely different place. So it was Suicide Circle first, and then it was actually some of his later films were which maybe I'll talk about in a moment, that I got interested in, then went back and looked at the stuff which went on between Suicide Circle and that. And then now, of course, now his output is Miike levels, Miike's most rampant, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, for myself, I mean, it was Guilty of Romance that sort of brought me in, and Love Exposure, and I had no idea who he was at all. I didn't even make the link between him and directing Suicide Club. I mean, obviously, I'd heard of Suicide Club, and in particular, obviously, that whole train sequence, which I think it was just like one of the most discussed sort of scenes for people who had obviously come into rediscovering like Asian cinema through like The Ring and Battle Royale. And it seemed like Suicide Club was like the next film that everyone suddenly wanted to talk about. But yeah, it was Love Exposure, and then I happened to stumble into Cold Fish again, not realizing it was the same director. And from there, it's obviously been film like that double header of Why Don't You Play in Hell and Tokyo Tribe. And it was those two films in particular I just absolutely fell in love with his work as a director. I think Why Don't You Play in Hell is probably one of my favorite films the last couple of years that I've seen. It's just so colorful and energetic and fiercely original. And he, like Miike, he's able to somehow combine scenes of graphic violence and somehow make it seem incredibly plausible, which is no easy feat, especially when you look at the countless splatter titles that are certainly available within Asian cinema. So
so maybe if I just give the audience a little potted history of Sono. So, and I'll use it, we'll start off, because I think the Miike comparison is actually valid. I'd normally sort of go, oh no, but no, this is absolutely valid. But Miike came from, basically, I think he came from school and fell into cinema rather than studying it, and acted as a, I think, like an assistant director somewhere, or sort of probably made the cups of tea first, then worked his way up through V Cinema, which is sort of straight to video cinema in Japan, and then eventually became the juggernaut and even the mainstream guy he is now. Sono came at it from a slightly different way. Sono actually started off life as a poet, and his life backstory, his early years, is fascinating. He joined a cult. He joined which, as you probably realize, probably has informed quite a lot of his earlier work. He's a published, recognized poet. His film started making gay porn. And then a lot of his early films, I'm going to confess I haven't seen many of them, but they're very much sort of art projects, half-formed ideas. And it's quite strange the way that Suicide Circle became popular. Because up to then he wasn't known outside of Japan at all, and he was probably an irrelevance outside of the real film schools, art circles. This was like in 2001, and it was just of the moment, wasn't it? It was a zeitgeist sort of film. It just hit that J horror wave and got him noticed, certainly in those horror circles. He followed it up with a whole bunch of other films. most of which haven't seen the light of day over here. More notable ones might be Noriko's Dinner Table, which is actually a prequel to Suicide Circle of a sort. It's talking about the same cult, but it's a much quieter, more standard fare. Then he gave us Strange Circus, which is quite a disturbing drama full of incest and Mikey-liked themes. And then I suppose 2007-2008, there's Exty, the film we're talking about tonight, so I won't spoil that. But his signature film, 2008, was Love Exposure, a four-hour epic about cults and panty shots and religion, and it's fantastic. I'm on record. I've struggled with films over an hour and a half to 2 hours long, and the fact that I could sit there and watch 4 hours of that madness and absolutely enjoy it just shows you where he suddenly shot up as a director. Love Exposure is considered part of a trilogy, his Hate trilogy, with Cold Fish, which you spoke about, sort of story of a aquarium owning serial killer, and then the rather fabulous Guilty of Romance, in which a woman's affair takes her, well, she's slide into prostitution, but they're quite complicated films, and they're considered part of the whole, even though I think they're quite different films. He then made a couple of films, Himazu and The Land of Hope, which take their inspiration, that they're more like dramas. One of them's almost like a documentary in its way it's filmed, inspired by the 2011 tsunami that hit Japan and the Fukushima nuclear meltdown. And then he came to another period of incredible output. So you've talked about Why Don't You Play in Hell, which actually was an old script he dusted off, and I'm not a huge fan of it because I think it's a bit backwards looking, but it's mad as a bag of ferrets. Story of a Yakuza gang making a film. It's meta as hell. And it's crazy. He dabbled in a TV show, the Virgin Psychics, that she then made into a movie. He created the rap musical Tokyo Tribe, adapted from a manga, as we spoke about last week. We've got Shinjuku Swan, Love and Peace, the soon to be released over here Tag, which is a meta commentary on schoolgirl horror, which is pretty good. Then an incredibly lo-fi science fiction film called The Whispering Star, which I really hope gets a release over here, because it just shows that he can actually tone it down and work at a really low, quite emotional, quiet level. It's a sort of it's a lot shorter, but think of it as a Japanese version of Solaris in a way.
Okay, I have to obviously ask. I mean, what do you think the chances are that the Whispering Stars distribution would get screwed up like Snowpiercer? So we're still waiting for Snowpiercer here in the UK. I know there's a lot of American listeners who can't believe that the fact we haven't seen Snowpiercer, but yes. We are still waiting for that movie to come over here.
If you'd asked me this a couple of weeks ago, I'd said the chances are nil. However, Tag has got a release, and it's out before the end of the year. Love and Peace came out, I think, through Third Window. I'm not quite sure what the audience would be, but I think there is a possibility. If there is anything we'll see next, it'll probably be Anti-Porno, which is... he's one of a number of directors who've been inspired to work on a project inspired by the Roman porno Pinko films. So he's done one called Anti-Porno, which has been quite well reviewed. That'll probably be the next one that comes out. But they keep on going. And I believe this year, if it's not out already, he's actually done a series for Amazon, Tokyo Vampire Hotel. So his grasp reaches ever more, but from a not a filmmaker at all, to experimental, to crazy batshit Mikey like stuff, to very serious dramas, to absolutely random output, the guy is absolutely one of the premier artistic forces in Japanese cinema.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting the fact, obviously, he's been picked up by Amazon to do an original series, as you said, with Tokyo Vampire Hotel. Whether he obviously chooses to stay and work, sort of work in both territories, remains to be seen. I mean, we've obviously seen other directors come over and they do one or two projects and then they just don't like the way that the system works in the West and just go back and essentially return to their homelands. And often in the case of like John Woo, return as these champion heroes. I mean, John Woo most legendary came over and he started off well. I mean, he did Broken Arrow, he did Face Off, and he seemed to be really sort of capturing the heroic gunplay style that he was like so renowned for. And when you look at like Hard Target and stuff, and then he sort of fell into this sort of chain of just bad projects like Wind Talkers and Paycheck, and then he basically just went back to Hong Kong and made Red Cliff, and he's quite happy being with Veers as the god he is. I mean, other directors like Hideo Nakata, Park Chan-wook, we've seen like one film from them before they returned. So it'd be interesting to see if Sion Sono decides to obviously hang around and make more than this series.
Yeah, I mean, you can add to that Kim Ji-woon, you can add to talking about Snowpiercer again. I think the Hollywood system they find restrictive. I went to a talk by Kim Ji-woon, and people asked him about he made the Arnold Schwarzenegger comeback film The Last Stand, and he was trying to be very diplomatic, but it was quite clear the level of control and upper interference that happens in Hollywood, even for somebody who feels like they would be able to operate in a more collaborative environment. It was too creatively constrictive for them. And so going back home and, like you say, being the homecoming hero and making really good films at a fraction of the cost, but with twice the creative control. And you've got to remember how big that Pan Asian market is. As important as we might think Hollywood is, the Chinese market and the Pacific Rim market as a whole is potentially bigger. So I suspect we may in the next sort of 30, 40 years see a complete shift in power. Mm.
I have to obviously wonder if Takashi Miike had obviously been working in the West, making films. Do you think he really would be on film 100 by now?
I'd be surprised to be on film 3, frankly. No. I mean, there are people who work with a prodigious output, but they are in, the big directors, they make what, a film every 2 years tops, and they get paid so much. Do they have to? And also what it takes to make a film now. I mean, we know we've spoken before about how long it takes. Oh, they've announced this project and then 5 years later it turns up. Well, it isn't that they just turned up for the 6 months of making it. You know, just the amount of people involved. I mean, the thing that always makes me laugh, so we watch the credits now, the end credits, and you watch a Western film and there can be 15 minutes and there can be a small town's worth of people involved in a film. I was watching a film from the 1950s the other day. I was having to review for Eastern Kicks, and it had something like 10 people. The credits were at the beginning, and it named all the actors, about 7 technical people, and of course there are other people not being there. But you know what I mean? That the you could make a film with a lot less than 10,000 people, couldn't you?
Oh yeah. But I mean, how do we feel? I mean, I forgot to mention this at the start of the show, but Takashi Miike, film 100, Blade of the Immortal, how are we feeling about it? I'm excited because it seems like more of what we saw with Harakure, and more importantly 13 Assassins. It's just, this seems to be 13 Assassins as shot through the lens of Izumi.
It's Takashi Miike adapting someone else's material, and for me that's what he does best, actually. His manga and anime and even his book adaptations, if we look at Audition, are fantastic. It's when, you know, or even when he's remade someone else's film, in the case of the other two films that you mentioned, when he's given a structure to work along, I think he's a much more successful director.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm excited.
Oh, definitely. Right, we are going to take a quick break now. When we return, though, we will be looking at our featured film for this evening, which is XD Hair Extensions.
So this thing we want to do, what exactly is it?
I think it's a podcast.
I think he just made that word up. But anyway, what would it be about? It can be about those things we see in the things, you know, with the pictures and the acting, and sometimes Ryan Gosling.
Oh, you mean films?
Yeah, those. We can talk about those. And Ryan Gosling. And what would we call it?
Women who speak weirdly?
Ladies? Young ladies? All the single ladies? Oh, wait, I know. Oh, chicks with accents.
Yeah, and we could use that song from the Beatles and that movie, Across the Universe.
Cool. Yeah. Listen to the Across the Universe podcast, brought to you by the Chicks with Accents.
Available just about everywhere.
And we're back. You are still, of course, listening to the Asian Cinema Film Club, coming to you live and proud on the That Moment In Podcast Network. If you've not done already, please do hit that subscribe button if you're listening to us on Podomatic or iTunes, or if you're just following us through thatmomentin.com. We obviously update on a monthly basis, so every month you will get a different film picked either by myself or Stephen as we continue our jaunt through the weird and occasionally wonderful world of Asian cinema. Tonight we are obviously looking at one of Stephen's picks, and you decided to go with a Sion Sono movie.
I did.
So, I mean, obviously, why this one? I mean, he's got an extensive back catalogue, as we've discussed already, but I mean, you obviously decided to go for the Killer Hair Extensions movie.
I did. So I went for it for two reasons. One is I clearly, from what you might have gathered from the first half, I'm a huge fan of Sion Sono. I wanted to avoid Suicide Club because I think that was a bit obvious, and I just felt this movie. And I don't know what you'll end up thinking about it, but I think it kind of got lost. It kind of got lost because Love Exposure came after it, and that was hugely lauded by the sort of the cult and Japanese film lovers. And it stars possibly one of the most famous Japanese faces of the modern age. I just felt it was a really good sort of introduction, although I will counter that by saying I don't think it's particularly representative of his work.
No, this is certainly an odd film, to say the least. The film, if you're obviously not familiar with the film, it basically follows this aspiring hairdresser, here played by Chiaki Kiriyami, who is probably best known for most people as playing Gogo in Kill Bill. She also played Chigusa in Battle Royale, so she was the girl in the lovely yellow running suit who also went and put a switchblade in a very uncomfortable place of one of her fellow students. And here she is in a much more innocent role. She's obviously this aspiring hairdresser who becomes the infatuation of this man who sells hair extensions to the nearby salons, unaware that the hair he's actually selling belongs to this corpse he's stolen, whose hair continues to grow, and because it is so beautiful and voluminous, he's just selling it as extensions, at the same time sort of fueling his own bizarre fetishes, because he's a trilophilic. And anyone who happens to have these extensions attached to them suffer these vivid flashbacks of the death suffered by the girl whose hair has been stolen and used for extensions. And this, of course, drives people insane. And as the film goes on, it gets increasingly more bonkers, to say the least, which we will obviously get to in a minute. But, I mean, you were saying this film was kind of lost in the mix. I can't help but feel that this was lost in the mix largely due to the changing of the guard when it came to distributors. Because obviously, when this film came out, Tartan had just closed shop. Arrow was still coming into their stride, so this was released on one of the smaller labels, and I think it was sort of got lost because at the same time we were still caught up in this whole Asian cinema horror boom. So it was just like another title sort of lost in the mix, because I mean, you had this, you had like One Missed Call, you had Pulse. There does seem to be this abundance in films, so this one kind of slipped through, much like The Isle in many ways, or The Dollmaster.
Yeah, well, actually, all good choice. But yeah, I think you're right. I think it came just at a time. Tartan was dying. The interest in J horror possibly was dying off a little bit. And when, you know, and people like Third Window were coming up, and this just missed, just slipped under. You're right. I mean, I've, you know, got a UK release, but it's very bare bones. it's got 8 scenes or something. That's its limit. It's still a pretty good thing, but it's a shame because it didn't build on the potential star power of what's her name, Chiaki, and also it's fucking mental. If you excuse my French, but it's a it operates in two completely disparate tones, and the story sort of does come together in the end, but the whole crazy hair fetishist morgue owner, morgue worker, along with hair sprouting corpse side of story, and then a really sad story about child abuse, frankly, that goes alongside it. There's the weird opening where they talk in this over-expository way, don't they? As if it was some like terrible soap opera, saying, "Oh yes, I'm now cycling down the road and I'm on my way to the job which I've had for the last 2 years, and I'm going to meet my colleague who has been here 3 weeks." You know, and it's like, what is this? This is mad as a bag of ferrets, but at the same time, that. The story about the young girl, her niece, although she calls her a sister, is it's sickening, really, isn't it?
Yeah, this film can never seem to figure out one particular tone. I mean, we obviously open as kind of a straight horror because we obviously have the body being discovered by customs agents in a container. And it's basically this body, and it's the whole container is just full of hair, which kind of gives you a foresight to what's obviously going to come ahead. And then we're then introduced to Yukio. As I said, this is Kiriyami, and she's as charming as ever. I mean, it's fun to see her playing a non-psychotic role, because everything we tend to see her playing is sort of a psychotic role. So to see her playing such an innocent and carefree character. I mean, as you said, she's doing her own self-narration as she's running down the road, which I found kind of charming. And the fact that she at least bothers to explain it isn't like some Asian aspects of Asian cinema where they're throwing some random thing and they won't bother to explain it because it's very Asian humour.
No, it is
explained.
It's having a little poking a bit of fun at Asian dramas, basically, and they absolutely, you know, that's the thing about Sono, I think, about a lot of his films have these sort of dual tracks going on. I mean, even Suicide Circle, you know, it seems to have this comedy level where it's almost like a Rocky Horror Picture Show pastiche, alongside some really disturbing stuff in terms of the suicide. So I find it's a decent pair with that. So in that regard, it feels very Sono-esque.
Yeah, and certainly if we're talking about disturbing scenes, the scenes of or the final memories of the corpse girl, I got so bummed out during those whole sequences. And it's really jarring, really, because we're kind of in this lighthearted mood. Yes, it's very daft and it's very overacted. And then we have these very sterile and cold moments of this girl who's basically been brought into this human organ trafficking ring. And we see her basically being killed and dissected and her hair shaved off. And it's absolutely horrific. And it's all done by these masked surgeons who are basically naked at bar surgical aprons and balaclavas. So it's a really interesting look to begin with. And we were forced to watch this whole scene. Sion Sono doesn't give us any sort of reprieve at all. He's like forces us to watch this horrible scene. And then we're back into more lighthearted. But at this point, it's sort of like, no, we're still trying to get over what we just seen there. And you mentioned already, we've obviously then got this whole child abuse subplot that runs through the film as well. And it brought back memories of Dark Water and the fact that we obviously have the divorce and the child custody storyline that's running through what is essentially a very traditional sort of ghost story.
I see that. Although in Dark Water, that's what's driving the story. Yeah. It's the story. You know, it's the story of lost parents and things like that. Whereas this, there are links between, you know, that the poor girl who is the corpse is obviously being kidnapped and murdered for her organs and for her hair, so that's an abuse in and of itself. And their mammy, the young girl, the niece, is being terribly abused by her mother, which is our lead character's sister. So it is kind of there, but it's, yeah, it's so dual tone.
I also have to ask, I mean, this film runs around the 2-hour mark, which I felt was a little excessive here, really. I mean, do we really need to have such a long film? I mean, this film could have been told in about an hour and a half. I'm not sure where you would cut it, but there certainly it felt that it didn't need to run as long as it did.
I mean, I could almost have done without our hair fetishist. I think it could have existed without him. Because that's a bit over the top and weird as well. he's having a bit of a campy bounce around, but you know, the corpse could have existed in and of itself without that, and we could have had a more straightforward horror story without him there. And that, I think that would have cut it down by at least 20 minutes. And you're absolutely right, Aaron. This is a hour and 20 minutes, hour and a half story that's stretched out 20 minutes too long.
I mean, for myself, it would be difficult to remove our hair fetishist, Yamazaki, mainly because this being an Asian horror film, and in this case, a vengeful ghost, we need someone for the ghost to take vengeance against, and he's the only logical target. Yes, we could obviously have the older sister who does meet a suitable demise earlier in the film, but we really needed for him to meet his demise just to sort of satisfy the ghost's sort of need for revenge.
Although he felt like he was in cahoots with the ghost most of the time. I actually found that when she turned on him because he was hurting the young child, that almost came from nowhere. I found that a bit odd. So I've got another one for you.
Okay.
The hair salon in which Yuko works in is called the Gilles de Ray Hair Salon. Gilles de Ray was a 15th century Frenchman, famous for being a serial child murderer, and is actually thought to be the inspiration for the story of Bluebeard. Yeah, the I call it fairy story with rabbit ears going on. Why would you name a hair salon, even in Japan, where they do love the French words, after a child murderer? And, you know, thousands of children he was thought to have murdered. It's just weird.
The only thing I can counter that with is, how many barbershops do you see called Sweeney Todd's?
This is, and I think you've just put the, I think you've just put your finger on what the joke is, and I feel stupid for not getting it.
Well, I mean, yes, it's a bit of a more vague reference for what they call the salon on this film, but yes, Sweeney Todd's, I mean, it's sort of like the barber who murders people and then drops them into the butcher's shop to be made into pies. That's what you're going to use as a mark of customer service.
Of course, here in Reading, where I live, we literally have a pie shop called Sweeney Todd's. The pies are very, very nice, but you do think that was a bit of a risky choice for a name.
Oh, God. Yeah, us Brits sure eat some crap.
We sure do. Or we sure did, I think. That's probably part of the problem with our diet, is that we don't eat everything anymore.
I don't know. I mean, I think how we obviously make these sort of make these sort of statements on Asian culture through the cinema we watch. There's obviously a large portion of the world that obviously view Britain as still probably being somewhere around the 17th, 18th century. So they think we're still very much about eel pie and anything that they've, it's all cobbled streets and Cockney accents over here. So,
well, and I don't mean to bore the audience with my stories. I was in America 20 years ago, so in the modern era, and I was staying on Long Island, and I got the train back from Manhattan and got a taxi back, because you can't walk anywhere, there's no sidewalks or pavements, as we would say. And there's a lady driving the taxi, and she said to me, "Oh, I love your accent, where are you from?" I said, "I'm from England." And I just thought, I won't complicate it, I'll just say I'm from near London. And she says, "Oh yeah, it's foggy there all the time, and there's wolves running around," because her only frame of reference for England was American Werewolf in London.
Oh God.
so anyway, and I'm guessing sometimes what our frame of reference for some of these cultures is exactly that, what we've seen in films.
Yeah, I think it's the advantage of the fact that we actually get more variety in the Asian cinema we get now, because I think it's certainly helping to shape our opinion of obviously life and culture in the East, especially when we look at Korean cinema. Korean cinema in particular is very socially satire, and it's very of the moment, compared obviously to like Japanese and Chinese cinema, or Hong Kong cinema, should I say. But no, this was certainly an odd one, I think, even for Sono, because it's so played so traditionally as a horror film throughout, and then he allows himself these random little asides, such as when we're obviously seeing our hair fetishist, and he's basically rocking the corpse back and forth in a hammock. And this is, he seems to have this full-on friendship with this corpse for whatever reason, and he's super happy when its hair grows, and he's just such an odd duck. You're surprised that anyone wants to buy hair from him. So,
well, that is a bit weird, because he turns up, doesn't he, with the hair extensions, the bells on for sale, and other hairdressers do, of course. Yeah, the Gilles de Rais salon must have more employees. They've got two chairs to cut two people's hair, and they have something like 11 employees. So he just turns up and sells them some hair stuff. But it sounded like this is it's not made very clear in the way that, but it sounds like this is what he does. And so when we first meet him in the morgue, he is cutting other corpses' hair off, isn't he? And he's looking for the right hair. So I think that's what he does. But finding the literal hair cornucopia corpse, knocks him off the deep end a bit, turns him into a transvestite, and then gives us one of the nuttiest screen deaths I've ever seen.
Yeah. I mean, you probably led into my next sort of point. The violence and gore in this film, it's light in the actual gore aspect. I mean, there's certainly some interesting things happening and hair growing out of unusual places. I mean, how did you actually find this? Because, I mean, in terms of obviously what we've seen from Sano. This is pretty light as far as things go. Yes, it has those uncomfortable moments such as the surgery sequences and the final memories of the girl. But at the same time, the most uncomfortable thing I felt about the hair is just the fact it looks so grotty when there's so much of it. Whenever we have a scene where there's like a room full of hair, it just looks so unbelievably grotty.
It does. And so it's funny you should say that, because I read a few, I was doing a bit of background reading, so I hadn't seen it for a few years, so I rewatched it this week, did a bit of background reading. A lot of people say hair isn't scary. Yeah, it's you know he's obviously making a point about people, modern culture, and people adding bits of other people to themselves, and what does that mean, and you know, that's probably where the poet in Sono is going with it. My youngest daughter, if she sees hair that's not attached to somebody, you know, like in the plug hole,
yeah,
she vomits. She has a strong physical reaction to hair. I don't think she's the only person, or a lot of people don't like hair, you know, when it's like just cut on the floor or something like that. And obviously, I mean, you're a married man, I'm sure your wife gets a bit stressed when she has a haircut. It's quite a common thing. So I think you and I maybe aren't the people who are going to be grossed out by the hair or the hair cutting or anything like that. And I just wonder if there's another audience somewhere. I mean, the CGI is adequate, shall we say.
It's interesting how the hair is animated. There's certainly a charm to it as well, because I mean, would you say it's stop motion? I mean, how was the hair?
Well, bits of it seem to be stop motion. Then when it appears to be going under people's skin and coming out their eyeballs and tongues and fingernails, it's, I think it's more like CGI. But yes, it seems to be a mix, doesn't it, of practical and fairly low rent CGI effects. But then I think some of the scenes, you know, there's the scene with the woman who, she goes sort of back to her flat and her hair shoots out in all directions and lifts her up to the ceiling and then chucks her down on the floor and then it all disappears. And I wasn't actually too sure if she died or not, but I think she did.
Yeah.
But that sequence is quite impressive. Certainly if you think of this as a, I don't think it would have been quite as impressive on the big screen, but certainly on my TV as a DVD or video watch, I thought there was enough interesting stuff there, although it was variations on a theme.
Well, I think the first scene where we see someone get possessed by the hair, and it's one of the hairdressers, and she's cutting this woman's hair, and she goes very close to her, her ear with a very sharp pair of scissors, and that had me gripping the sofa a little tight. And I think that's going to be reflected in what I'm going to obviously choose, one of my selections for the further viewing for this particular film. So,
yeah, I know it's not gory, so don't. It's not extreme Japanese horror in any way, shape, or form. It's a humorous film, and it's winking at you most of the time with a pretty dark underbelly. And I just think it's a complete outlier for Sono, in the sense that it's a bit like One Missed Call is for Mikey. Yeah, it's a perfectly good film, and it's got lots of good stuff and lots of bad stuff. But is it representative of their oeuvre? No.
Yeah, I think there's definitely other films that I would recommend watching of Sono's first. I wouldn't use this as your benchmark to judge his work by.
No, I'm definitely thinking of it more as a gateway than a benchmark. He's made far better movies, but I think it's pretty accessible.
Yeah, I think if you're gonna start with Sono, I think starting with his later films, so really anything around 2010 onwards, I would say, is going to be a good sort of starting point, and then work backwards once you sort of get comfortable with styles. I mean, things such as like Cold Fish, if you're feeling adventurous, then obviously Love Exposure's another particularly good one, or just Tokyo Tribal, Why Don't You Play in Hell? I know you don't like Why Don't You Play in Hell, but I think it's still a really fun one to start with. There's a lot of interesting movements and certainly bursts of color in that one to certainly make it worth getting a look.
I think of Why Don't You Play in Hell very much in a similar vein to this film. It feels, because it is actually based on a script he wrote back at the beginning of his career. It's another mad, there's a bag of ferrets film, but it's using tropes that we're aware of, and it's quite meta, isn't it? And it's a perfectly good, if not great film, Why Don't You Play in Hell? It's just not one of my favourite of Sono's, that's all.
Yeah. Further viewing, I mean, where'd you obviously go from here? I mean, it's a unusual film, and certainly one that it's not the easiest to try and match up with something else, I think it's safe to say.
Okay, well, I have got a film in mind. I think you might have already chosen it as a further viewing before, but I can't remember. I'm certainly planning to talk about it in a future episode, but I'm thinking sort of crazy experimental horror film, Japanese. How about Nobuhiko Obayashi's Houzu?
Yeah, Houzu is definitely a very good choice. I think it's one that we're definitely going to be discussing on a future episode. That is a film which has got this absolutely wonderful legacy of being this bonkers horror film, and when you start watching it, it's so charming and delightful. I mean, the cat's eyes sparkle, and it's got such a nice warm glow, and then it suddenly pulls the rug out from underneath you and turns into this absolute bonkers Evil Dead style horror film.
Yeah, I think if you want a crazy Japanese double bill, but you want to keep it on the right side of tasteful, I'd match XD along with Houzu for sure.
Cool. For myself, there's a couple of different options you could go. I mean, we mentioned already Dark Water, just obviously for that combination of that darker style, obviously with the child custody storyline running underneath this Chinese ghost story. But I have narrowed it down to like two choices. One is actually not an Asian film, it's actually a Western short, and that's The Stylist by Jill Gerber. I'm going to really apologize in a bit. In advance, I'm really going to screw up her surname, but it's Gevargazian. It's a little 4-minute short revolving around, again, head and cut in. So I'm not going to say any more, but just advise you go and check out The Starlist. The other film I want to obviously say would be Survive Style 5 Plus, directed by Jen Sekiguchi. And this is a film which features five interconnecting storylines, including this man who constantly tries to kill his wife only to find her alive again, a salaryman who's convinced he's a bird, and most bizarrely of all, it features Vinnie Jones appearing as this connecting thread between the five stories as he goes around with his translator, played by Yoshi Arakawa. This is a truly bonkers film. I've not really seen it more than a couple of times since it was being released, but certainly if you're looking for a mad film to pair with another mad film, then Survive Style 5 Plus would be the way I would go.
No, that's a good choice, and there is one other that I spoke about briefly last time when we were talking about manga adaptations. Would be the 2000 Akira Higuchi's Uzumaki, the Junji Ito adaptation. Crazy, lots of spirals, and that includes a bit of hair as well. So I think any of those would make a suitable pairing with XD.
Cool. And that brings us to the end of another edition of the Asian Cinema Film Club. We hope, as always, you've enjoyed it, listening to this evening. Again, please come like us on the Facebook page. Let us share your thoughts on Asian cinema. We try to put something up every day or so. We like to share trailers and different bits of film that we find. So plenty happening over there. You can also find us over on thatmomentin.com as part of the podcast network. And if you haven't done already, hit the subscribe button either on Podomatic or iTunes, wherever your preferred chosen method of listening to the podcast is. And you know, maybe leave us some comments or a nice rating. It all helps move the show forward. But obviously, next week we are going into Halloween, and we are going to be celebrating all things Asian horror by having a very special guest on, and we are going to be holding our first ever draft here on the show, as we are going to be competing against each other to see who can come up with the best 5-film draft for Asian horror. And I'm don't know about you, Stephen, but I'm kind of interested to see which way you go, whether you're going to play it safe, whether we're going to go into some like real deep cuts. Because, I mean, as I say, Asian cinema, Asian horror in particular, is sort of one of those genres that we don't seem to talk about as much anymore. It was like the real in thing when we had this revival of interest, and now we all just seem to want to watch classy sort of fare rather than just watching Asian horror.
Yeah, well, I mean, the joy of it is, it's a bit like we were talking about last week when we talk about the manga and the anime and the fact that there's such a widespread of it, is that we could go Hong Kong Cat 3, we could go guinea pig level hardcore Japanese, or we could go somewhere in the comedy horror vein, which might be where I end up. But you know, and then I think that's the point. There will be some classics, I'm sure. Us and our special guest will pick on some known classics, but I will try very hard to find a couple of deeper cuts and maybe some light fare myself.
Cool. Obviously, in the meantime, if people want to come and read your stuff, Stephen, where can they find you?
Well, you can find my writing at easternkicks.com, and my own blog at guelorambling.wordpress.com, but I've got to be honest, haven't done much recently. Plan to sort that out.
Cool. As for myself, as always, it's from the depths of dvdhell.blogspot.co.uk. And I'm currently obviously still working on stuff for thatmomentin.com. The movie tourist series is still going well. We recently posted the latest entry being for NORAD in the film War Games. So we were talking about hackers and killer computers. We are going to be looking at Kung Fu Hustle in the next entry, where we obviously be looking at Stephen Chow's sort of last major film for Western audiences before he sort of disappeared back to Hong Kong and now sort of is sort of below the radar for most Hollywood viewers. But it's going to be obviously be fun to obviously go back and look at some of the interesting casting choices that he made with Kung Fu Hustle and get into the whole scene there and exploring the secrets that film hides. So thank you as always for listening, and thank you to my co-host Stephen.
It's a pleasure as always. Thank you for having me.
And we will be back next time with our Asian horror draft. But until next time, good night. Hey!昨日の恋は忘れて昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ月が砕けちっても星が燃えて落ちても踊り続けていたい夜なのさ は忘れて昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り
り続けていたい夜なのさ。